Before you tune in, we would like to issue a content warning. This episode contains discussion of difficulty conceiving and miscarriages. Please listen with caution if you are currently pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant in the near future. If you or a loved one have questions about options for challenges conceiving, please visit PlannedParenthood.org.
30 years ago, in a windowless laboratory room in Berkeley, a young Esther Kim was plucking out her eyelashes to make microsurgical suture. From the bowels of frog gastrula research, Dr. Kim's dream of microsurgery was born. She is now a regional leader in microsurgery, an advocate for gender-affirming surgery, a devoted wife, and a proud mother. For me, this episode was really an example of why we have communities like WalkPRS. During our interview with Dr. Kim, we addressed the real, raw issues that women in surgery all over the world face. How do we prepare our body to grow another human being while giving everything we have to our job? What if we want to be a powerhouse in the OR and also a loving wife? What if, as much as our heart and mind is ready for a baby, our body is not?
I had miscarriages after miscarriages. And I think it had to do with my chronological age. I was like, my eggs were, I was just miscarrying.
Welcome to Nevertheless, She Stitched, a podcast dedicated to hearing the voices of women of color in plastic surgery. My name is Cassandra Carrion.
And I'm Aga. Let's get into it.
Thank you for inviting me, guys, first of all.
Sure.
And I wanted to get to know you guys first. I think this is going to be fun. Cool. I'm a first generation, if you want to say. I was immigrated here when I was about 8. And, you know, being Korean American and parents who had a pretty decent, careers in Korea, gave all of it up to come here. And I guess, you know, being immigrant kids of Korean parents, you become either a doctor or a lawyer. And it was kind of embedded, not even just from your parents, from like your aunts and your, like everybody. Day one, I came to US and they're like, you're going to become a doctor, right? When you I think so. It was embedded in me. I don't even know if I ever even thought about doing something else, honestly. So when I went to college, I went to Cal Berkeley. And, you know, I was really into art too. Like I liked art and architecture, you know, but, you know, that whole thing, how are you going to feed yourself in art? And they're like, you have to go into the sciences. You got to be pre-med. So I think I tried to do art and sciences at the same time. And then I had to drop art. There were just too much like labs and studio time that was conflicting. I just couldn't have both, like, you know, having a science, you know, you get OCHEM and physics and math, calculus, all that stuff. And on top of that, like studio time for art. And you just have to invest a lot of time in art if you want to be successful. So I ended up just choosing art as a hobby. And I remember it was so, I've always known, even in college, that I was going to do something with my hands. So when I went to med school, I had a feeling that I was going to go into a surgical field. I didn't know about plastics, though. Not at all. But, you know, fast forward a few years, you know, I met my husband during medical school, and I still didn't know what I wanted to do in surgery. I was going through surgery. And when you're in surgery, I'm sure you've heard general surgery. They don't really like it when you decide to go into plastics. They discourage it. It's so funny, right? And so I think I kept it quiet, or like I didn't really, they didn't even make us rotate through plastics. They were afraid of like losing us to plastic. So they don't even have rotations. I remember I got lucky somehow. I got created. It's like I got an elective and I did plastics. And then I started to explore plastics more. I didn't really know what plastics was. Just like everybody, it is cosmetic surgery, right? But there was so much more. And my husband, who's just so smart than I am and just wise, you really need to explore plastics because you haven't figured out what you wanted to go into. You keep switching from vascular to Pete surgery to every time you rotate, you're switching, you know? And so because he knows me and he's like, I bet your plastics is going to fit you the best because you haven't been exposed. And so I delved into the plastics and of course it was like meeting your like perfect spouse. Like, I'm like, this is definitely me, you know?
One of my first jobs out of college was as a research tech in a neuroscience lab. We were studying the dorsal raphe nucleus. Now, fellow neuro nerds will recognize this region as being the serotonin bank of the brain. Fellow rodent neuro nerds will recognize it as a nearly impossible area for in vivo imaging. Well, as someone who spent hours and hours in a windowless room trying to get my mouse experiments to work, I definitely appreciated what Dr. Kim had to say about her earliest work in microsurgery.
When I was in science, it's also my first lab position that I did research in. It was in a cell developmental biology lab. And I remember I had to make knives and scalpels and loops of things, instruments that you were going to do micro dissections using my eyelashes and eyebrows. And I had to make them because the instruments were not available at that time. That was that fine because we had to dissect frog embryos or gastrula or blastula phases from an embryo that was tiny on the microscope. And I had to peel it off so that my PI can study how these cells were going to move in development. I was like, oh, that's why I liked microsurgery, or like it kind of all kind of like came full circle when I found plastics and then I found microsurgery. And I just thought, oh, what a great field for me.
Yes. I left. What? That is so
cool. Yeah. And so I got lucky. I feel very fortunate that I found a field that is very representation of me, who I am. And it fits my personality and my skill set probably.
Yeah.
Not everybody can find that in medicine. It's not a perfect fit, you know?
That is so cool.
We want to take a moment to warn our listeners about the upcoming portion of our podcast. Please proceed with caution if you're currently pregnant, trying to become pregnant, or are sensitive to difficulty conceiving.
I tell this to my residents probably, or students probably a lot, and then to my residents about children. You know, when I was young, in college, I thought I could do it all. You know, I wanted to have it all. I wanted to have a career. I want to be a great mom. Be a great, you know, wife, work out, have a hobby. I thought I could do it just everything. Like, but as you get older and you go through medical school and residency and you eat humble pie and, you know, you realize when life sits in, you can't do it all at the same time. You need help. And for the longest time, I think I was just focused on career. That was me. But I tell my residents to, if you want family, you need to really think about this. I think it wasn't talked about as much back then, you know, like especially even in general surgery training. No, none of my female attendings had kids or really married. So nobody told me you should freeze your eggs, or you need to think about your chronological age for, you know, fertility. So I got married in my last year in general surgery, the beginning of it. And then about a year after that, we were thinking about having kids, but then I couldn't. I think I was just too stressed and I just couldn't conceive. And then I just gave up. So then we got a dog. And then I don't know if the nurturing of a puppy and things like that. And then I just got pregnant without trying with my first child. So when I went into plastics, my daughter was born. Yeah. So I did a 2-year plastics. It was the last year of the 2-year plastics fellowships. And so she was born. And so I went through plastics with pretty much a baby.
Wow.
It was really hard because in the beginning, one, it's your first baby. And then I was trying to juggle, you know, just like everybody, pumping and be trying to learn plastics. And, but I think, like I always tell my residents, to make it good, you have to have two of these three things. Either you have to have time to have kids, or you have to have money, or you have to have help. As a resident, you don't have time, which means you have to either have lots of money to hire people to help you, or you need to have help. And so, you know, any combination of those, like that's what you need to have. So it could be your parents or, you know, a nanny or an au pair or something, you know. And it could be your husband who's going to help you stay home or like do most of it. I think you definitely need that. So I had an aunt who lived with me who didn't have a husband or her kids are all grown, who helped me during plastic surgery. After 2 years, I became a fellow at UCSF, and the fellowship year, I didn't really try, but right soon as I became attending, we wanted to have another child. And I had miscarriages after miscarriages.
I want to give everyone a chance to process Dr. Kim's journey to motherhood. Unfortunately, her story is not uncommon among working women. And it's definitely not uncommon among female surgeons. In a world where women represent approximately 1/3 of plastic surgery residents, a study by our very own Dr. Wendy Chen found that, on average, plastic surgeons give birth to their first child at 34, which is older than both the national average and the average of U.S. women who hold a master's degree or higher. And what's worse, plastic surgeons are nearly 3 times as likely to have a miscarriage. So, when we say powerful women, we're not just talking about a statement logo on a canvas bag or a sticker on your laptop. It's necessary to be powerful if we want to survive in a working world that wasn't created for us.
And I think it had to do with my chronological age. I was like, my eggs were, I was just miscarrying. So I kept miscarrying and I kept, like, and so like, I think 5 years went by like that. Yeah. And so then I decided, my husband and I talked, and we decided to try IVF. And we had IVF, and we had a discussion about how many rounds we're going to do. And because it takes a toll on the woman a lot, you know, and what are we going to do? Like all of these, how many rounds we're going to try, and if we did this much, we won't try anymore. All of these discussions were done before, because I just thought it might be too hard at the time to make a lot of these decisions when you're in it. So my husband and I said, we'll do 2 trials, and if it's not successful, we'll be done. Because there are many women out there and families that try forever and they don't succeed at all. And so I decided on 2, and I just said, I'll give it my all, everything. And I'm going to stay healthy, and I'm going to do all this, even though it's all voodoo, who knows what works. But I gave myself self-injections, and then I had retrievals, and it was crazy. Every step of the way, they told me that you're going to lose how many embryos you have, and also my chance was 3% of a healthy baby born. But it was so true. I had, by the end of the freezing, and I did all the genetic testing of the embryos and everything, and out of the 9 that I had survived, only 2 was healthy. And all of them was not going to make it if we, you know. Those 2, we decided we couldn't choose. We just decided to let fate decide, and we implanted both, and we were just lucky, and I had twin girls.
The miracle twins.
Yeah, every time I talk about it, it gives me shivers.
I'm getting emotional even just hearing your story.
Yeah, because like, I was like, oh my God, like I felt like it was meant to be, just 2, and that's it for me. And luckily they implanted and had a successful pregnancy. I pretty much carried them to term and they're healthy. So I told residents that there are many women like me, I'm sure, and that it's honestly, there's no good time. It's when you feel like you're ready to be a mom and your spouse or significant other is ready. You know, I sometimes think it's best time is residency, to hear the truth, as long as you have some help, because there is really life. I don't know if you've heard this from anybody else, but as you go in life, there's more stress and more things added onto you that you didn't think about when you were in residency. It's just a lot more responsibility, a lot more things happening. You know, now, like, you were a renter before. Now you're a homeowner. There's a lot more things that come with the homeownership. Why you know, not? Before you were dating, now you're a wife. There's a lot more to that, too. Like, so now you have a kid. And so, I don't know. I just, and when you're, I mean, when you're not attending, there's, yes, you have control over your schedule, but your responsibilities and how busy you are, it still goes up. So I think there really isn't the best time. And if you're ready, you shouldn't delay it. And if you don't have that, like you're not, or if you're not in a situation where you're not ready to have kids, I think you should definitely think about your chronological age and consider freezing your eggs if you want to have a family.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned those three things. It kind of feels like a formula for success as a mother. So since you've had children, Dr. Kim, have you noticed any changes in policies or education for residents who want to become parents?
You know, I'm a strong advocate for this. So, but I know that UCSF does not cover egg freezing yet for residents. And I think they should. I think we have also, you know, in the last few years, the residency has developed a union.
Yes.
And so I think it's something they are working on. And I'll be, you know, I'm totally supportive of it. However, UCSF is very progressive in terms of supporting our female residents, in terms of they want to have kids and all of that. I know it's challenging for the other residents and the program director. We have to shuffle and everybody, you know, but I think we try to build an atmosphere or support system within that, you know, women shouldn't feel guilty about taking their time as they need. And also, I'm a big proponent that minimum of 3 months is required. And after that's like, to me, a minimum. I wish we were like Europe and we could do more. But yeah, you know, 6 months to 1 year, like I think is like, especially twins, you should get 1 year. Single, fine, 6 months. But minimum 3 months in the U.S. I think is needed. However, a lot of times a lot of women only get 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And I think that needs to change too for our residents. Hopefully, you know, the board will allow this and also the ACGME will like make changes because it's ridiculous. You know, I try to be supportive of all my, you know, mom residents, if they want to, you know, whatever they need. I've heard of other residencies that do cover IVF and freezing eggs. And so I think it's starting, that wave is starting. So I'm really happy to hear that there are residencies that cover freezing eggs.
Since Dr. Kim had her children, UCSF union negotiations effective July 1st, 2022 until June 30th, 2025, provide residents with 8 weeks of paid parental leave and a maximum of 7 months of combined parental and family leave. When I, together with my WOC PRS cluster, Dr. Webster, Dr. Chen, Dr. Lai, and Dr. Nguyen, surveyed program directors on resident fertility and family planning, most of them agreed that 6 weeks was enough leave for a childbearing resident. And they were pretty neutral on whether or not a union actually aided in advocating for reasonable parental leave for residents.
What's UCSF's current policy for leave? So, like you said, the ACGME gives us 6 weeks. What is the graduation policy for UCSF currently for integrated?
So, we don't have a mandate unless it's by the board.
Oh, wow. So it's case by case?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So whatever we can work out with the board in terms of, like, time off, because you have to do a certain number of weeks to sit for the board exam. That's basically, there's a requirement.
So we actually looked up the official leave policy of the American Board of Plastic Surgery, and we'll sum it up for you here. The main points being that the American Board of Plastic Surgery established an optional 3 months of personal leave for both integrated and independent plastic surgery residents. The next point being that these 12 weeks or 3 months, however you want to view it, can be used all at once, or you can kind of spread them throughout residency as they deem necessary. And they can be used for a multitude of instances, including maternity leave, paternity leave, medical leave, foster care, adoption, family leave, and even elective rotations in the U.S. or abroad.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the UCSF union? When did it start? How old is it?
I wish the physicians, the faculty could have a union, but we're not a part of it. It's just a resident union, you know? I think it must have started a few years ago, before around the same time COVID started. They start to unionize, and I think it made sense. I was like, you guys need to. They didn't have any say. No, they were not part of. They weren't at the table making some of these decisions. They're the ones, like, even in psych, they're the ones that were in the hospital, not the people who are at home doing Zoom visits or whatever they're doing. And so I think those kind of things made them speak their minds. And so I don't know the nitty gritty about the UCSF union, but I just know that we just struck made a deal with the GME office made a deal with the union, and it's just been rolled out. And it was, and I'm like, great, whatever we need to do is fine. One of my passions is residency education. Residency well-being. I'm always the support of the underdog. You know, like, the residency is the residents are the underdog compared to the med center or the GME office. You know, like, who has the power? I mean, like, they do. Like, no one. You know, right? And so, I'm always I will always stand on the side of the residents or the students to advocate.
That's awesome. If you had to pick. For example, if you got to be president of the ACGME one day, what rule would you pick? What rule would you change?
Definitely the salary and the work hours, probably. And I mean, most likely, I think the salary and probably leave for women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I do think the residents are so underpaid. It's ridiculous. I remember when I used to get $45,000 a year. When I was an intern.
And how long ago was that?
2004.
Okay, so it's been almost 20 years, and there hasn't even been a $20,000 raise, or barely.
Barely. Right? Barely. It's ridiculous.
For your reference, $45,000 a year in 2004 is the equivalent of about $73,000 today. But the average resident salary in the U.S. today is between $48,000 and $71,000, despite the fact that the cost of living has almost doubled in the last 20 years.
One of my favorite parts about interviewing these brilliant women is learning about the different ways they find balance at home. In our fight for equality, I think it's more important than ever to talk openly about how to make a power couple partnership work.
Speaking of support, name something that your husband has done to support you. So, because I want also.
So my husband is, he's a different ethnicity than I am. He's Belizean, so he's a Caribbean. And so my kids are half Black. And he's also a physician. So we have a two physician family, which is really busy. I think and I told you he's way smarter than I am. So the biggest thing he's done for me, I have to say, and this probably brings tears to my eyes, is he's given up his academic career to be at home. Not like home, but like more of a community job, and be at home with my kids to drop offs and pickups or to activities and things like that, so that I could have my academic career.
Wow.
He's probably, if he had, he would have succeeded way probably faster and probably more than I could, because he's a lot more, I don't know, he's a lot better, well spoken, he's smarter, he's wiser, he's more, he's a leader, he's all of that. And I'm more of just a plastic surgeon. I just want to go fix people, you know? But he gave up that, because there was a time when we had to decide, when there was only one, it was kind of doable, but with three, it was just, it's not possible.
If you feel comfortable talking about this, would kind of love to hear what it's been like for you as a non-Black woman to be a mother to Black women, basically, and especially with everything that has been going on in the media lately. Obviously, African-American people have been facing the issues that have been recently talked about forever, but for you,
yeah,
you have a different lived experience. So what lessons have you learned? What, maybe can you tell us something you've unlearned or anything kind of poignant in that sense?
It is the strangest thing, because there is, like, you know, unspoken, I mean, just racism that just comes out. Like, things that are, like, even as a family, when we travel, it's, like, the most bizarre things happen to us. My husband and I are usually at the end. You know, the kids are in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so one person leads and the other person is at the end, making sure everyone's corralled in, right?
Yeah.
When we travel, even, like... Like, let's say if I was the lead and I'm giving them, like, all the tickets for everybody and we just all go, they stop my husband. They think that he's not part of the group.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, those things happen. Like, even though I say, okay, here's the 5 tickets, and they'll say, like, oh, and he has to always stand with them. So you have your, yeah. I mean, these things happen to us.
Yeah.
Or, like, we go to the restaurant and we were just trying to sit as a family, and they'd be like, and he has to always say, I'm with them, like, that's the family, which is very I was like, don't you guys see the mixed kids? I mean I don't get it. But I mean, we still live in a very progressive, very white neighborhood, though, even though it is progressive and it's California, so it's not in your face, like, racism that we see. My daughter goes to probably 100% minus point her and maybe to her other friend that are all white in her school. She
wow.
goes, yeah. And I guess what I've learned, I mean, this, you know, I grew up in a very diverse, non-white community growing up, being an immigrant, right? So one of the things that, you know, my husband and I talk about a lot is, do we need to live or be in an environment that's diverse for our kids? And that's something we've talked about in the past. And that was then, do we uproot our kids now when they're younger? And then just, we need to grow up in a, I told my husband that, you know, the world is still very white dominant. And it's a very still white world. And I really want our kids to feel comfortable navigating in a white world. And so I decided to stay put or stay in this community so that they can be comfortable in it. I mean, we stick out. I mean, we go to town or walk around. Everybody recognizes my girls. I mean, they make nice comments. Oh, you could. I mean, they're mixed. So they're like, oh my God, what beautiful daughters you have. What a beautiful family. That, so I walk around and they'll be like, oh, I saw your kids with your nanny. They're like, now I have no idea who they are. But I mean, we stick out. That's the one thing. But I just And I'm not sure. I wouldn't know if what I'm doing is the right thing or not until they grow up again and I guess and see, because, and this is a decision we made, you know, that I don't, and, but everyone, every family has to probably make that decision, you know?
Yeah.
Cause when I was, cause I did my undergrad and med school in California, everything in California. And then I went away to different states for plastics and general surgery. It was a little bit of a culture shock. I remember when my when I was in high school, my first trip to visit my cousin in Kentucky, and I had my first real true racism, like in your face experience, and I was just like blown away by that, and I didn't even know how to deal with that because I was so young, and it was the first time. It was like what you would see on TV's kind of thing, what you hear about. I met these girls, and the girls invited me to go out to a party, and I went, and they were all white girls, I guess, but I went, and I went to a party, and they started to call me names. Yeah, it was like in your face, like they call me, they don't even know, like typical things like chink and oh my god, what is that smell, and who brought, you know, the, you know, yellow, like all kinds of stuff like that are just like, and I was like, what year am I living in, where am I right now? And so that was like my first, I think, like really bad, like personal, like in your face, like racism. You don't have, like, you hardly ever face that when you're in California, right? Like that kind of, unless I'm crazy, like not in schools and not at parties like that to me. And it was like that. And so I think that I went away for residence and fellowship. It was much better. I was older. I was able to handle situations. Yeah. People are more mature at that age. They don't do it like that, you know, like, I mean, but it was still weird. I mean, there's a lot of cultural differences and even political views and, you know, that are different by state and by age and gender, everything. And so I think learning those, how to navigate those and, you know, and being comfortable hearing all this stuff, I think it's important. And so I just think I just wanted my kids to get exposed to that. I guess that's early on, so that when it's they're faced with it, they know how to handle it, or how not, or ignore it, or how to navigate the situation.
Speaking of that, I guess what advice would you have for somebody professionally who faces an instance of racism or discrimination on how to handle that while in a professional setting?
Oh, if you face racism in a professional setting, I think that hands down, I think that should be reported. I don't think it should be tolerated. I think a lot of times this is usually people who are the perpetrators. It wasn't their intent, right? They didn't really, it's not in your face. They didn't mean it in that way. I didn't mean to, like, but it wasn't perceived that way. It's the person who's receiving it. And so they need to be aware of that. Like, usually the perpetrator is like always saying, but that wasn't my intent. They're just being so sensitive. I didn't mean it. Well, I think that's because you're lacking awareness and their cultural and their experiences, what they're coming from. And I think that has to be awakened. I think that's what it is more than anything. I think little mistakes are happening and it's because they're not aware of it. It's a blatant ones. I think that is just, they just need to report those. Those I just don't think even can tolerate that kind of racism in this current society. It should not be even, you know, tolerated.
One of Dr. Kim's specialties is gender affirming surgery, specifically top surgery. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with these terms, gender affirming surgery refers to any procedure that would increase the gender congruency of a patient. This is a fancy way of saying that plastic surgeons get to help patients transition into a gender that they themselves identify with. This is mainly achieved through facial feminization or masculinization, breast augmentation or removal, and modification of the genital area. It's no secret that patients who seek these procedures have often faced discrimination and barriers with access to care. Cass and I have both individually worked with transitioning patients who are often have been told in the past that, like, they'll grow out of it or it's just a passing phase. But here at WalkPRS, we use facts to publicize patient care. A 2015 study found that among transgender adolescents, 35% reported depression, 51% had thought about suicide, and 30% had made at least one suicide attempt. 5 years later in 2020, a JAMA study analyzed mental wellness among the transgender non-binary youths and found that recipients of gender-affirming interventions, including puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormones, were associated with 60% lower odds of moderate to severe depression symptoms and 73% lower odds of self-harm or suicidal thoughts during the first year of multidisciplinary gender care. In lieu of the ever-present legislative interests in regulating gender-affirming surgery, particularly concerning decisional regret long-term, a 2023 fall study from JAMA Surgery tackled the issue head-on, evaluating decisional regret and satisfaction with decision using validated instruments in patients who receive gender-affirming mastectomies, more commonly referred to as TOP surgery. Unsurprisingly, the authors found that individuals who underwent gender-affirming mastectomies attested low levels of decisional regret and had high satisfaction. Dr. Kim knows how crucial it is for these patients to get the help they need, and so we felt super honored to hear her discuss these experiences with us and her take on what it means to really be a provider for this patient population.
This population of patients have been, you know, historically marginalized, you know, and I think finally, you know, we are catching up and providing, and we have still more to go. I mean, even the current political environment, like, it's making it more, it's hindering us right now, actually, in California. Especially with underage surgeries or hormone therapies. You know, when I first got into gender affirmation surgery, I did not know much about it because there was no training at that time when I started. So I had to learn everything kind of, and figure things out. And I didn't realize how fulfilling, and patients are so grateful. This population of patients are so grateful in plastic surgery field. I mean, you will not find more grateful people. In a plastic surgery, I remember when I was a resident, they said the most satisfied patients are breast reduction patients, that have, you know, massive breast reduction patients. They're the most satisfied patients. But now that, like, in service question will change. I swear, it's the gender non-conforming patients.
Wow.
Because they are so grateful and so satisfied after TOP surgery. When I first started doing this, I think every visit I had with patients on their first post-op, it was everyone cried.
Wow.
Patients cried, their partners or parents, they all cried. It's like emotional. They feel themselves in their body, and it's just, it's amazing when you see those kind of, how much impact that you have in their lives, improve their quality of life and how their self-esteem and just viewing themselves. They just feel whole. They view the surgery date as their birthday a lot of times. And they remember it and they celebrate it. And it's like, it's amazing, actually. Kids get to use, they've grown up this way and they just want to have top surgery, you know, and before going off to college, they want to have bottom surgery, right? So there's no law, and we follow the WPATH guidelines.
WPATH refers to the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to promoting evidence-based care, education, research, and public policy in transgender health. The most recent standard of care WPATH booklet includes guidelines for transgender medical treatment across specialties. So, for example, WPATH thinks that adolescents are eligible for top surgery once they have three things. The first is a comprehensive biopsychosocial assessment. The second is parent or guardian involvement, if possible. And the third, and I think this part demonstrates their commitment to a multidisciplinary approach, is a letter recommending gender-affirming medical and surgical treatment that's written by both medical and mental health care professionals. So in theory, this organization sounds like exactly the type of advocacy transgender patients need and frankly deserve. But unfortunately, the state of transgender healthcare in the US is very different based on where you live. In March of 2023, for example, Governor Bill Lee of Tennessee signed into law a total ban on gender-affirming healthcare for transgender children and adolescents. But even in California, a place where we might expect more transgender-friendly care, patients and providers still face difficulties.
However, the California law in terms of consenting for any big surgery or procedure is 18, age 18. So that's a little bit of a, the current political climate and the demonstrations and things that's been happening in our area have pretty much forced, or if you want to say, us to come up with a, you know, a statement, a universal statement where UCSF is not providing any underage surgery, for especially bottom surgery. Top surgery is on a case by case. It happened other places earlier, and California kind of, it didn't happen until this past year, in 2022, where it just got the New York Times articles started to come out more, and a lot of the private doctors are not protected. You know, they're just very exposed, right? And so it makes sense for them, you know, because they're getting a lot more, you know, threatening phone calls to themselves and to their staff, and probably even to their family, who knows. So I'm not surprised that they have chosen that route, because the amount of the pressure and what they will feel if something ever happened to even their staff or anyway, it's just too much. So working at an academic or big hospital, that it's, we have a little bit more protection, you know, but yeah, basically we follow the WCAS guidelines, we do, you know, and but we limit. And yeah, it's very sad. I've had so many patients and families. They're just so desperate and they don't know what to do.
So I recently sent out a survey among patients who had received top surgery, where patients who were born biological females opted to remove their breast tissue, leaving them with a more masculine-looking chest. Our survey assessed how quality of life for these patients had changed before and after surgery, and hearing about how hard these patients have to fight just to feel at home in their own body, and how happy they are when they finally get to go under the knife, reminded me of a response I got. When I asked everybody to talk about how their surgery made them feel in the comments, a lot of them talked about their healing process, their pain, both physical and psychological, and some talked about how their friends and family reacted. But the one that stood out the most, I think, was somebody who I remember being really quiet during our appointments. And their comment read simply, "For the first time in my life, I'm just happy." So I always like to ask these rapid fire questions just to see what kind of fun things are like living inside the brains of people we interview. So let's do this.
What was your first job?
It was tutoring, probably elementary kids in high school.
Favorite cuisine to cook?
Probably Italian.
Favorite surgical tool?
My Irish scissors.
Favorite anatomical structure?
Eyes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, that's so interesting. Coolest surgery you've ever done?
Oh, that's hard. Probably reconstructing the face after a gunshot wound.
I like that. And then after a long day in the OR, what is your favorite snack or drink to have when you get home?
Oh, when I get home. I don't even wait until I get home, girl.
Okay.
because I can't wait the 40-minute commute, okay? So after a long case or long day, when there's nobody even in the hospital anymore, my residents then, or my fellow, or we go to the recovery room, and we look into the fridge, and there's usually a ginger ale and cranberry juice, and we mix half and half, and we cheers and take a shot.
I love that.
On a characteristically rainy day in San Francisco, we are spellbound by Dr. Kim's gripping stories detailing her journey to plastic surgery, the birth of her three beautiful daughters, and the fulfillment from providing gender-affirming surgery to her patients. We learn how politics and prejudice can interfere with the transgender community all too often. And lastly, we hear about her version of what qualities reside in an incredible partner in crime and the three golden tickets for motherhood and residency. This podcast is sponsored by Women of Color in Plastic Surgery. Guest bookings and interview content are collaboration between Dr. Wilmina Lanford, Cassandra Carrion, and Ogechukwuanu. Social media content is curated by Dr. Wilmina Lanford, and music was written by Gabriel Luce. If you would like to learn more about our organization, or if you would like to become a member, please visit us at walkprs.org, WOCPRS.org, and follow us on Instagram at walkprs.